So, Ham, guess where I am today?
So, in the background, I can see a lot of white, a few plants. You're in some sort of greenhouse?
It's in quite a posh building, actually. It's called the Royal Agricultural Hall. Well, it's not anymore. It's called Islington's Business Design Centre, is what it actually is. I'm here with Martin, and we're actually at a podcast conference. So, we're trying to learn how to do our job. That's the aim.
That's podcastception. So you're hosting a podcast from a podcast show.
Yeah.
Are there any good freebies?
I could get you some socks. It's not like the old days at the farming shows. Do you remember those paper caps you used to get from like Farmers Weekly or Farmers Guardian? It's like a hat made out of a piece of paper, and then you'd be able to like pull it out and it would go on top of your head. It's absolutely no use whatsoever. Couldn't protect you from the elements at all.
I've had a lot of stressed pigs and cows and sheep in my time. Never had a paper hat. I think I've dodged a bullet there. Hi, I'm Hannah Clark.
I'm Phil Maiden, and welcome to The Ag Show.
This week, we'll hear all about an HDB project that's been 7 years in the making.
And we'll be back to Devon to speak to beef and dairy farmer Derek Bambury, as he's joined this time by his neighbour, Derek Gow.
That's right, but first up, we have the Wilsons, Ian and Anna Wilson, to tell us more about Challenge Sheep and how they've been looking to improve ewe lifetime performance through breeding and condition.
I think one of the biggest things about upper body condition scoring is, as long as you're consistent yourself, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. As long as you're confident of where they are within your flock, I think that's one of the most important things.
And in part two of our look at the new film, Derek vs. Derek, Derek Gow tells us why he turned his back on farming to embrace nature.
So about 10 years ago, we'd start to take down the fences, start to disperse the sheep and the domestic cattle that were here, and then really start to look at changing pastures by reseeding them with yellow rattle, digging very many pools, putting log piles back in, just creating as much living space for other creatures as we possibly could.
A reminder, we've got new episodes of The Ag Show dropping every Wednesday at midday, and they're available wherever you get your podcasts.
With audio and video versions for every show, just subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode.
And if you want to get in touch with us, please do. We'd love to hear from you. Comment on any of our social posts or email agshow@ahdb.org.uk. Now, we're kicking off this week with quite a big one. It's the wrap-up of Challenge Sheep, which is a long-running project digging into how body condition and breeding ewes as lambs or shearlings shapes lifetime performance.
The project followed the performance of replacement ewes across 11 farms in England, covering a real mix of production systems. Up in the northeast, Ian and Anna Wilson were part of it. They've been telling us their story, but first up, here's a bit about their farm.
Hello, we farm 550 ewes on the outskirts of Middlesbrough. They're quite close to North Yorkshire Moors. The majority of them are Texel and New Zealand Texels with a few Suffolkses. All lambs are sold, finished, the majority of which go on contract to Tesco, with some going live weight through a local auction mart.
Now, the project ran for 7 years, and Anna admits they've seen a lot of change in that time.
The farm itself has evolved massively with sheds and polytunnels and increase in sheep and like the way everything has gone. It was really lovely actually to see the changes within all the different farms as well. So there were children born and people getting married, and it's been a really nice process, hasn't it, actually, of just like 7 years together is a long time to see things change. Yeah.
The other interesting thing was the day we started the Challenge Sheep project, lambs were £3.75 a kilo dead weight, and I was selling lambs at £5 a kilo live weight on Tuesday night, which just shows a little bit how lamb prices have gone. And I haven't dared look to see how fertiliser prices have gone with it, but I assume it's a very similar increase.
It's quite stark how the price of everything has gone up. Ian also told us why they got involved in the project.
There were a couple of things, really. One, we were changing our breed at the time. We were going away from a very traditional pedigree Texel flock to a lot more easier management grass finishing flock. So I wanted to use the Challenge Sheep project, look at other farms as well, see how they were doing it, compare the small improvements we've made in the time to other people's and see how that was working. But also we collected a lot of the data already the challenge shape wanted. So it wasn't a massive undertaking for us to do it because we weren't changing what we were doing greatly. We're changing a few timings, but nothing too serious.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to live in your own bubble of your farm. Sometimes you will get out and about with local farms, but actually it was really nice to then compare to other farms around the UK. So there were upland and lowland, and like we're absolutely spread out across England. So I think that was really nice to see that, you know, some of the challenges that we have, other people have had, or we've overcome some that have maybe helped others.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like all those involved really pulled together to help get the best out of that project. And farmers being farmers, there was the bonus of a ready-made excuse to go to the pub.
We've had some really good discussions. Most of them have been in the bar afterwards. But you learn a lot more through the informal bit sometimes than you ever do during the formal bit, don't you? And having a good natter. And the one thing we've said right from the start, we were all very, very honest with each other about our systems and our figures. So what you see is what you get with sort of all the farms. So you know that you can talk about things that have really happened and everybody there has probably had the same problem. So it's really nice to discuss it all and say, well, actually, we've had this and we fixed it by doing this, or have you tried this, or have you tried that?
Yeah, I think from the beginning, from that first ever meeting, we all agreed that we were just going to lay the cards on the table and be honest with one another. It was never going to be a competition. It was never about, oh, my farm's doing so much better than your farm. It was all about working together, wasn't it?
Yes.
Making sure that data was absolutely spot on and actually reflected what was happening on our farms.
Ian, who's a Leicester Tigers fan, judging by the top he was wearing, told us what they were required to do as part of the Challenge Sheep project.
Record weight and body condition score at tupping, scanning, lambing, 8 weeks and weaning. And we also had to record lamb birth weight and sires and things like that, just so that we could follow lambs back to see what the body condition score of the ewes, the effect it had on the lambs as well. And the lamb weights were recorded at 8 weeks and at weaning as well.
Now, given the length of time involved in the heart of this project, we asked Anna and Ian if it had made them think about how they manage their younger ewes or shearlings.
We don't lamb ewe lambs. I keep threatening to and keep thinking of reasons not to.
We did when we had the accident there.
Yeah, we haven't done it on purpose, let's put it like that. Some of the data out of Challenge Sheep are beginning to make me think it could be worthwhile doing, but when we started the project, we had a lot of problems with mastitis in young ewes, and that was one thing we really needed to look at. And just better management through better feeding, better pre and post lambing management as well. Because you assume that a shearling's your biggest, strongest, fittest ewe. Well, actually, it doesn't matter when the lamb, they need more attention than we were giving them. And during the 7-year project, we managed to really, really reduce the amount of mastitis. So hopefully that's a very big benefit just through losing sheep, that we weren't actually losing many through death, but it was just losing them out the flock and having more and more sheep having to come in.
Yeah, I think it's very easy, isn't it, to look at your young, fit shearlings and think, well, they're in the prime of their life, you know, they'll cope well. And actually, they've not yet finished growing. They're not at their full mature weight. And by having that first lamb, you're putting a lot of strain onto that ewe, especially when she's still growing herself. And I think it's what's come out of this Challenge Sheep project is actually realizing that if you manage them separately, and I mean, when I say separately, we haven't done a lot of extra work, have we?
No,
you've
really.
Just put them in a different field and we look after them and give them a little bit more TLC, really. And I think that's really changed our shearlings, hasn't it? And we're not having to cull so many, which is obviously a bonus.
After 7 years of monitoring their ewes, Ian and Anna had this advice to those looking to do the same.
I think one of the biggest things about archery body condition scoring is as long as you're consistent yourself, it doesn't matter what anybody else does, as long as you're confident of where they are within your flock. I think that's one of the most important things. And body condition scoring as a whole, I think it's just having your hand on them fairly frequently. Every time you have them in, have your hand on them and just keep an eye on them, because what the Challenge Sheep project showed is that the change makes a difference. So you've got to be able to know when to step in and say, well, actually, some of these sheep need a bit more grass or they need less. And it's just being able to manage the entire flock around your body condition score, rather than just thinking, oh, I've got a few thin yows.
Yeah. I think as well that we've noticed that we do have ewes that will drop quite a big body condition score post-weaning, but then actually they recover really quickly. And so you see a pattern emerging for different sheep. Some sheep will sort of stay relatively consistent. Some have quite a dramatic drop, but it's actually knowing that that is normal for that sheep, that actually she's following that pattern every single year. And really it's when they start stepping out of their normal pattern that you then realise that maybe there's a problem, and that she might only have dropped one body condition score, for example, but actually when you start looking at it, she doesn't normally. She normally only drops half a body condition score. And in that instance, you then start to think to yourself, okay, maybe she's starting to struggle a little bit more. Is it because she's getting older? Is there another underlying cause? And I think that sort of data has often passed people by. It's all right doing your body condition scores, but actually when you look at that data, you're getting so much more information per sheep.
So how has the Challenge Sheep Project helped Anna and Ian look at their own ewe mortality, and how do they select ewes for culling?
Well, we are incredibly lucky that we have Ben Strugnell at Farm Post Mortons not too far up the road from us. So all dead sheep on the farm go up to him to get PM'd, so we know exactly what the root cause of all our deaths are. I would say generally there isn't one root cause on the farm, it's just sheep being sheep. So in terms of deaths, we're relatively happy that we know we haven't got too big a problem, touch wood. Culling strategy, we collect an awful lot of data. So I can tell you everything about the sheep throughout their entire life. Whether it's actually worth some of the time we spend on it, I'm not certain, but that's for another discussion. But we can look at all our sheep, and basically anything that has lambs in the bottom 25% weight-wise at weaning go onto what we call the naughty list. And they're allowed on it once, and if they're on it twice, then they go. Generally speaking, a lot of the shearlings are on it in the first year because they have lighter lambs, so that's taken into consideration. But again, it's just to make certain the performance is there all the time. There are some favourites that make it on the list every year that somehow manage to not get culled, but some of them might be my wife's, might be Anna's, but we won't go into that. And there's the odd favourite that you keep because you like them. And I don't care what anybody says, we've all got them.
Another person who's helped the Wilsons during their Challenge Sheep project is their vet, Dawn.
She has a massive impact, yes, doesn't she, on us? I mean, we're so lucky to have Dawn, who has recently won Agricultural Advisor of the Year at the Women in Agriculture Awards, which just goes to show how amazing she actually is. But we have such a good relationship with her. Like, not only does she do, like, flock health plans, but she really looks into everything for us, doesn't she? And it's not just a quick fix. It's how can we move on? How can we improve? And she's always just a phone call away from any problem that we might come across and how we can fix it. I mean, she's really come. We've put her through her paces, haven't we?
We have done.
Definitely. One of my sheep in particular has put her through her paces, which she always threatens she'll have a full chapter on this one sheep when she writes a book. But she's absolutely brilliant. I don't know what we'd do without her, to be honest.
So what's next for Ian and Anna?
It'd be very interesting to see when all the data comes out. And we've seen a lot of the data over the years in sort of individual little parts, but seeing it all together as one lump will be very, very interesting to see what the actual outcomes are. Because we've seen enough data over the years to guess what the outcomes will be. But obviously, by the time it's all finished and collated, then that'll be the real test of what we've done over the last 7 years.
Yeah, I just think that you can look at our data from 7 years and it's mind-blowing. So what will it be for all of the Challenge Sheep farms over 7 years?
If you want to learn how other farmers like Ian and Anna Wilson, as well as the vets, have been able to use the findings of the Challenge Sheep project to help them manage young ewes and to optimise ewe performance, then come along to one of our Flock Foundation roadshows.
Now, there will be an event near you from June to September on a range of farms, and will cover upland, lowland and hill farming systems. Go to hdb.org.uk/events to find the one nearest to you. And you can find out more about the Challenge Sheep Project on our website as well.
Hi, I'm Alice Perry with the latest from AHDB for the week commencing the 25th of May. Our chair, Emily Norton, has responded to the latest Farm Assurance Review Progress Report, highlighting work on 14 key recommendations and continued efforts alongside industry partners to support changes within the farm assurance schemes. We've also published a joint paper with the NFU outlining the purpose, scope and value of farm assurance. New opportunities for UK agri-food exports will follow the UK's trade deal with the Gulf Cooperation Council. Tariffs are to be removed on products including dairy, cereals and lamb, helping improve competitiveness in a region where demand for high-quality imports continues to grow. And farmers have the chance to get ahead on environmental planning with our new series of baselining roadshows. The countrywide events happening in June will provide practical guidance on measuring and understanding farm data. That's all for now. Find out more at ahdb.org.uk.
Welcome to AHDB's Forage for Knowledge update for Friday the 29th of May. This week's average growth is at 70 kilos of dry matter per hectare, but with the heat we've had this last week, that's likely to be slowing. Ryegrass gets stressed above 25 degrees C, where growth can slow or even stop. With temperatures as they have been, cows will have been under heat stress too, affecting feed intake, production and fertility. Whilst grazing, consider what practical steps you could take to reduce this, looking at water access, fans in collecting yards and housing during the hottest part of the day if needed. On grass quality, the averages this week have been 20% dry matter, 11.7 ME and 18.6 protein. I'm Emily Udall. For more analysis and commentary from Piers Badnall, go to the AHDB website and search Forage for Knowledge.
Right, brace yourselves. This week, we're taking another look at the new film Derek vs. Derek. And if you can remember, it's a documentary that looks at farming versus rewilding, or maybe not versus. We'll let them argue that part out.
Last month, we spoke to Devon beef and dairy farmer Derek Banbury. He's back again, but so too is his neighbour from the opposite side of the lane, Derek Gow. Before we speak to him, here's a reminder of what to expect from the film when it's released.
It's like he's gone mad. This is the difference now. This is my farm hedge, which has been trimmed. And this is a rewilding hedge here. What a bloody mess.
Every year he comes to see me and says, would you like your hedgerows cut, Derek? And every year I say, off.
Population's getting bigger. It's not going smaller. And everybody's going to be happy if they've got full bellies. Unless it's good maize. Look at this. And it's up to my head.
This is my land, and I'm going to heal it to create life.
What Derek's doing is such a mess. He's spoiling good land.
When the country's starving, they'll understand what
they
know. I know.
It says, bullshit, con artist, there you go. No, I don't care.
We're talking about reintroducing the wolf in England. How are you thinking about it?
Not good. Not good.
Why not talk to campers and see if they want a load of wolves eating them up the ass?
In the last 70 years, we lost more animals, insects, than the 11,000 years before.
They're lovely birds. They used to be here, then they were made extinct.
They could be made extinct again, perhaps.
I want change. I want change.
So that's a little snippet from the film, and if you're interested in watching it, there are going to be a number of screenings going on during the summer, and the film's going to be available in cinemas this autumn. So let's speak now to another Derek, because we spoke to one Derek last time. Derek Gow's with us as well this time. Derek, just before we get into talking about the film itself, can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and how you ended up becoming the rewilding guy that everyone's arguing about?
Who am I? Well, my name's Derek Gow. I'm Scottish. I was born in Dundee. I started my career in agriculture in the early 1980s. And then I became involved in nature conservation. I worked in the conservation sector for about a quarter of a century. 2003, I bought a farm just down the road from Derek Banbury. and farmed for a little while, and then decided I was turning the whole thing over to nature. I'm not sure that anybody is talking about me, but it's a very nice view to say so.
So when farmers hear about the word rewilding, you do get quite a few kind of thinking it's taking land out of food production. Are they wrong about that, or are they bang on?
In the end, it will involve taking land out of food production. But when you actually look at it, 35% of the land we farm produces 2% of the calories, and 85% of the rich land, which is mainly in East Anglia, produces, you know, the bulk of the calories we consume in Britain. So when you look at it, farming could only operate in these poor areas on the basis of subsidies, and the subsidies are finishing now. There's a very good economic case for doing something different with the land, which involves restoration of lost biodiversity, purification of water, retention of water, and rewilding has much to do with those aspects of land use.
And do you enjoy winding farmers like your neighbour up a bit, or is that just a side effect of saying what you think and what you believe?
I enjoy winding you up quite a lot, and you enjoy winding me up quite a lot, don't you? Yeah, we both enjoy that very much from a personal basis. No, not really. And I mean, to be quite honest, I think for very many people, there's not a huge wind-up in it. When you explain that a lot of that has to do with just changing the landscapes, cutting off odd wet corners, thickening hedgerows, you know, making sure that there is space for other things to live as well. So it's a compromise. And you're cutting off land that produces nothing anyway, then it's no big deal. This whole rewilding thing, which is a tiny, tiny percentage of the land use in Britain, it's maybe out of the 50, if it is 50,000 acres, it'll be doing well to be that. And, you know, against the very many millions of acres that are 70-odd million that are farmed, I don't think there's really that much contention in this issue at all. It's a contention that's entirely made up.
Is there a point in your life where you kind of had like a bit of an epiphany about your views?
I used to keep a lot of sheep, and actually I liked sheep very much. I mean, my family, my great-grandfather's family, you know, kept very many black-faced sheep in the Scottish border. So I've had plenty of time out at shows and sales sorting out sheep. But in the end, when you start farming here, you just begin to realise that what you're actually doing, I mean, in the time I was here, I saw the last of the curlews, the last of the whimble, the last of the short-eared owls, the last of the hen harriers. You know, in the end, it becomes a bit of a burden when all these things go just because you're doing something in the way that everybody else does.
I'm super fascinated by your dynamic. And for those that are listening, Derek and Derek are in the same room. So I'm loving the dynamic with the brews on as well at the moment. what did you just hold up there, Derek?
I love the last of the biscuits. Are there any chocolate ones?
I'm giving him coffee and biscuits here.
We need all the chocolate ones.
Derek, when we hear the word rewilding, I guess it's a big topic and it's very complicated. And in sort of land use, we talk about land sharing and land sparing and saving, you know, big areas for conservation and taking that out of production. But obviously we've got to do this in conjunction with producing food to feed a growing population. How do you sort of see UK land use going over time? And do you think that, you know, rewilding is something that can be done on a more granular level and everyone can sort of take part in, or is this something that should be kept more separate?
Well, you can take part in it if you've got a garden, on the basis that you can start to leave rock piles in your garden, dig ponds, use British wildflowers to attract insects. There's much people can do in a small scale. But if you're looking at the landscape, I mean, the government's own projections for land use, which were published a little bit 3 weeks ago, suggest that to see an appreciable difference, and let's not forget that Britain is an island, which is, you know, when nature is all but destroyed, we're in the 10th lowest in terms of biodiversity nations on Earth. But you need to have about 30% of Britain returned or returning to nature with, you know, by 2030. And that's going to involve about 9% of the land going back into, you know, the production of nature, because we've so squeezed it that, you know, even at the corners, I mean, Derek, you know, can remember, you know, you told those lovely stories about the time when the grandfather was here, you know, the wet meadows in the bottom where the curlews, you know, laid their eggs, or the kinks in the hedges where the glowworms were. Why did we have to straighten all these out? Why did we have to drain them all? It's not because, you know, it's produced any more food. It's because the incentives from government and from the European Union were there to do these things. They didn't particularly mean, they weren't designed to kill the curlews and the lapwings, but that was the net end result of what happened. So when we talk about rewilding, it's not all just about the return of the wolf, though personally I think that would be a good idea, which Derek definitely doesn't agree with. But it's about how do we actually look at the land in a different way and say, right, these bits around the edge, which produce nothing, which are too wet, or, you know, in the Eastlands are too sandy, you can't do anything without irrigation. These bits go back to nature, and then we basically see how we join up, you know, the dots and the corridors and the maps of Britain to ensure that things can, you know, have breathing space, there is enough food for other creatures, and life starts to reform if it can, because we've done so much damage to the species that were here, that were once really common, that for some of them, their time has come. So if you want one just quick example, there's a blackbird called a ring ouzel, pink blackbird, it's like a thrush, white ring around its neck. There's one pair left living in Dartmouth. That used to be a common bird. And when you do the DNA on them, it's the mother and her son. There is nothing else left, and that's all our fault.
And how long has your sort of rewilding journey been, Derek? How sort of long have you been changing your land and changing your farm?
Not long.
Not long. I mean, really, I suppose we started changing the farm because we had some animals here for photography for many years. So about 10 years ago, we'd start to take down the fences, start to disperse the sheep and the domestic cattle that were here, and then really start to look at changing pastures by reseeding them with yellow rattle, digging very many pools, putting rock piles back in, log piles back in, just creating as much living space for other creatures as we possibly could.
Mm. And what changes have you seen? Have you seen increases in certain species or any new ones sort of making home on your land time?
The birds have been the most interesting because we've had things like stonechats return to breed here because the gorse is regrowing again. You know, really big flocks of goldfinches forming towards the end of the summer. You'll have, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of these adult birds with their chicks. Linnets about the same. Skylarks are returned again. And then really where you walk through, I took Derek down and you'll see in the film to the bottom of some of the meadows, the wildflowers are growing well. And you can stand, and when you stop talking, you just hear this low buzz in the background. So the insects, the butterflies, swallows, house martins, sand martins have returned in considerable numbers.
And I know this, I watched the trailer and there was sort of a lot of talk about hedges and animals getting through the gaps in the hedges and why, you know, Derek Banbury decides to keep his hedges tight. But so that's maybe not an ideal impact of your rewilding efforts, Derek Gow, but I wonder if what the benefits might be of your actions over the hedge.
Derek, bless him, is a neat and tidy farmer. He's very proud of his vegetables being neat from here to the Dead Sea or wherever they stop. What my hedgerows do is different. They give the birds song perches. So in the spring, the male birds can go out and sing their mating calls at the top of these A-framed hedges. You get a lot of berries, you get a lot of nuts, you get a lot of cover of different sort. But what you actually don't get, and at some stage we'll have a chat about this, is that when you look at Derek's hedges, because much of his hedges are exposed to sunlight, you get this kind of incredible display of primroses, red campion, a variety of other wildflowers very early in the year. And what we will probably do this year, under my supervision, of course, you know, bollocks, is we'll go along some of the big wild hedges I've got and we'll cut out scallops in them to open them to the wildflowers, because the wildflowers are the things that feed the butterflies too. So it's a compromise. If you just let the hedges grow up completely, then you have some things but not others. But if you actually start to manage your hedges in a way that's kind of different, then potentially you could do everything. So it'd be a nice thing we can work together on that.
I can't believe you just said that.
He's gonna have to go for a wee lie down now, actually. So it's
so is there a friendship? Is there a symbiosis sort of forming here? If there's benefits across?
Oh, we've always been friends. We've only had once when we had the wild boar. I rung Derek up and I said, I think we got wild boar in our land. And Derek said, we left. Yes, he lost some. They've escaped. And he admitted it. And he said, I can't do nothing, Derek. Just get somebody to shoot them with a rifle. So that's what happened.
A wild boar not quite destructive for your nature plans?
No, they're not destructive from any point of view what I want to do, because what they've done is we had them for a number of years. Now there's only two, and they are very tame ones that come, you know, when you rattle a bucket. So they're not sort of things that are going to be jumping fences. But what they do is in pastures that are flat, that have been flattened by ploughs, flattened by people, de-rock, you put the wild boar in, and the boar basically are ploughs. They go back in, they dig the land up, they expose the seedbed to annual plants, And then ultimately they open the seedbed, you know, for the perennial plants to take over. So what you end up with are meadows that are not just ryegrass, they're full of knapweeds and a whole host of, you know, red campions, a whole host of other flowering wildflowers, which of course is great for the insects and for the butterflies. And also wild boar would make loads and loads of wallows in hot weather. In the wallows, you get, you know, frogs laying their eggs, toads laying their eggs, dragonflies laying their eggs. So the boar reefs fault landscapes, if you no longer want to farm those landscapes. And of course, after all, they're a native animal. They should be here. And in some parts of Britain, like the Forest of Dean and the west coast of Scotland, there are very big populations of them developing. And in some way, they are restoring themselves for Britain, but difficult in intensively farmed landscapes.
I was just going to say, I think the wild boar point is a really interesting one. I mean, in the pig markets at the moment, we're watching ASF really, really closely. And on the continent, a lot of that spread has been in parts due to wild boar. So it's just an interesting proposition, I suppose. And I guess we need to be cognizant of the risk around disease spread. Have you got any reflections on that?
Yeah, well, most of the pigs we're fattening are fattened in sheds. Wild boar don't have keys to the lock. How's this going to be a major issue?
Well, there's a lot of pigs up country outfield, isn't there?
Yeah, for outdoor pigs, it's going to be an issue. But you see, what we've always done in the past is every time there's a threat to our domestic livestock from anything, we always view wild animals as being the only thing, the only issue, and we go and kill them. What we never do is we never look at our own behaviour.
I think we'll take a little pause now and we'll hear more from Derek and Derek and James after the break.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Twinbarrow, analyst at the AHDB, here with a look at the domestic dairy market for the week commencing 25th of May. GB milk volumes have now slipped into marginal year-on-year decline and we are now past the seasonal spring peak. March deliveries were 0.1% lower year-on-year and May-to-date volumes are down by 0.4%, though this is against a record high. In the latest UK wholesale price survey for May, prices remained under pressure, impacted by ample supplies of fat. The average price for mild cheddar was £2,940 a tonne, 1% lower than the last period. Bulk cream prices remain at half the value of a year ago. Minimal movement in the average month pricing gave an average for the month of £1,220 a tonne. The butter price moved down £200 a tonne, 6%, to £3,330 a tonne. However, SMP average prices did see another month of strength, ending at an average of £2,500 a tonne, a month-on-month increase of £140 a tonne. This is the only commodity that is more valuable than a year ago, as demand for protein remains strong. For the latest data and analysis on red meat, dairy and arable markets, head to ahdb.org.uk and click on Markets and Prices.
You're listening to The Ag Show with me, Hannah, Phil and producer Martin. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us, please do. We'd love to hear from you. The email you need is agshow@ahdb.org.uk. But let's get back to Derek v. Derek.
It feels the whole kind of rewilding narrative often focuses on conventional farming practices. And I appreciate that you've got some quite strong views on that. But do you think the focus is disproportionate onto agriculture, bearing in mind all the other things that are impacting wildlife in this country? Because I often hear us talking about the impact of farming, but what about the impact that house building, road development has had, those sorts of things? Are they kind of not taking as much of a responsibility as maybe farming does for these issues that we've got?
There are many problems with many things. So the road building and the isolation of creatures within islands of roads, we know to be a huge problem. You know, things like, you know, the rubber that comes off tire wheels, I can't remember the exact details, but it's now been shown that this can combine with other natural elements and pollute water courses in a way that leaves you with these awful forever chemicals. It's us. Farming is a big part of it. But, you know, when it comes to it, you have to bear in mind that when people talk about farming as if it's like some sort of, you know, something out of Lord of the Rings and there's the orcs. It's not like that at all. What you're dealing with are a bunch of individuals. There are a lot of very brilliant people and very kind farmers like Derek, you know, who do what they do very well. I mean, you see some of the awful bits of footage, you know, of animals being mistreated. You know, he doesn't behave in that way with regard to his cattle. In fact, he spends an awful lot of time playing with them in the fields when he should be working. But the long and short of it is that, you know what, it's, the most sensible way to pursue all of this is to look for what middle ground there is and see how you adapt to the middle ground. But that requires both sides of the debate to find space. And maybe that will mean that there are some areas of the landscape or more, you know, net castles in the way that Charlie Burrell's changed his land and the wider countryside, where only thing that matters there is nature. But then the nature, when you produce it, has to go out to the wider landscape as well. And it can only go out to the wider landscape if we reshape that landscape to give it a home and a food resource. So, you know, how do you find a middle way? But this argument, when you look at things like the white-tailed eagles being reintroduced to Exmoor, and yet again, you've got this stupidity about they're going to eat lambs. There's no evidence.
The video, he picked up one on Dally.
The evidence is dead. It's not kicking and screaming. It's wiggling like that because it's dead as a donut. You know, and there's no evidence of anywhere else in the world of these things being a significant problem for sheep. Why all of a sudden would there be a problem here? If you look at the project in the Isle of Wight, they've not killed a single lamb. You know, all those eagles are radio transmitters on it. Yes, they look big. When you're very tired at lambing time, you can see why people just get angry about them feeding a dead sheep, but they don't kill them. So,
well, they would, didn't they? I bet they would.
No, they would. Not like the golden eagles.
Yeah.
Wrong eagle. The white-tailed eagles do it. We won't worry about the golden eagles. Anyway, you don't have to worry.
Don't worry. Then the commentator said, don't worry. There's plenty of sheep out there for the eagle to eat.
And actually, you've been a horrible little dog. What's that? That's just about the size of that eagle we could see.
That's my daughter's.
It's about that size. It's really horrible.
The worst thing in farming is starlings. We've had enormous lot of starlings this winter. And they go in all the sheds and they poop everywhere. And they seem to be getting bigger.
Is that bigger in numbers or physically?
Bigger in numbers. Bigger? In numbers.
The starlings are now the size of a dot. It's actually brilliant. You come into Derek's farmyard in the wintertime, you can put a bird watching hide just out behind the house here. There's a number of starlings form these great murmurations when they go to roost. And of course, they've been roosting in Linda's garden where she planted all the conifers. So what you've done is created starling heaven and provided them lots of food. Well done. Does that make you feel happy?
No.
Derek, would you say there's probably an education piece coming out of this documentary in regards to rewilding and the impact?
Yeah, well, I mean, that one film that we had down in St. Giles, nobody was fighting at the end of it all.
No. There was a lot to think about. Somebody asked me in the market yesterday, because I get, you know, every time I get quizzed about the film and when's it going to be released? When can I see it? All these questions. End of the day, which is right? You know, which is right? It didn't make you think.
Yeah. And yeah. James, have you worked it out? You're the one who's editing the film. Have you got all the answers that we need?
No, I'm a filmmaker, but I, as you can see from the pair of them, they're really good to film with. They are enjoyable people to spend time with, and they have a really interesting relationship. I haven't got the answers, but I do. I know one thing: we need food, but we also need nature back. And there must be some way of finding our way through this as a, you know, as a nation. That's what I hope.
Yeah, I think everyone will agree with that, James. And you know, we all know we need food, and we all know we need good nature as well. We could chat all day because it is fascinating. So unfortunately, we're limited by time on the podcast, but. Really, really, I'm finding it very interesting talking to you and hearing all about this. It really resonates kind of with our farm at home. We've only planted trees. We've not removed hedges or anything. We've only grown our nature on our farm. But I wouldn't say we're particularly kind of nature focused. It's just kind of part of what we do on the farm. But, you know, there is a bit of balance feels sensible.
A lot of it is easy. It's like if you've got wet spots, smash the drains, put pools in. It's not going to cost you anything. It's not going to make any difference to your bottom line at all. And then if you have rubble, make sure you always put it in big, sunny, exposed. I mean, if you've got your hedge lines and stuff facing south, because that gives your insects a chance, then the reptiles come, then the predators are out. There are little things that can be done that make a huge amount of difference. And they don't affect, you know, in any way, shape or form, you know, the commercial operation of a farm. Looking at the landscape in a different way and figuring out how and you can make space on that basis.
Derek Bambury, I'm just interested. Obviously, there's a lot going on in farming at the moment, and the dairy sector's seen quite a lot of pressure recently with the milk price and where that's going. I'm interested, where does this whole sort of debate sit on your priority list as a farmer?
Well, it don't affect me, really. I do my bit on the farm, trying to fence off woodland and corner of fields and all that, like we've done it in the past, and I'll be doing more in the future. But we don't let it affect the farming, because farming's our main priority. That's where we get our money from. That's what pays the bills and pays the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And it'll never affect that, as long as we've got a right. As I know, the milk's dropped immensely. We were getting 46 pence a litre, now it's down to 33. But we got a ride over that, and to go up, it's just as fast as it dropped, I think, in the future. Because you see the price of cows yesterday was terrible again, up £3,500 each. Well, I can't understand it. And you can tell, giving a lot of money for calves, isn't it? Everybody's looking for the 2 years' time when everything gets scarce, I think. I don't know why they are giving as much for calves, but I'm looking to the future more.
And I suppose these kind of rewilding efforts and improvements you can make to your bottom line are sort of good for business resilience generally?
Of course they are, yes. Everybody, all farmers love to see nature every day. When you go out with a tractor, you love to see the pheasants and the birds and the foxes and the squirrels. And you love to see it. Yeah, it's part of life, isn't it?
And James, look, this film's coming. It's hotly anticipated. Where can our listeners go and watch and listen when it comes out?
The film will be on in cinemas in the autumn, and we're hoping that will extend into the winter and maybe even into the spring all over the country. But ahead of that, what we're trying to put in place is a farmer screening program where we can get a film out to farmers, in pubs, cattle markets, wherever you want to see it. And if you go to our website, which is www.derekversusderek.com, you can sign up, and there's a form there, and you can just put your name down and we'll come back to you and try and make this arrangement, because we really want the film to be a sort of focus of this kind of debate. It felt to me there's so much polarization about this issue, but actually, when you scratch the surface, there's much more commonality than you think, and much more shared experience.
Yeah, we'll make sure to put the links in the show notes. It seems like this is just the start of a conversation, and I'm really excited to see the outcome of farmers going to watch the films and people on the rewilding side of the fence going to see the film and just the conversations that will happen off the back of it.
Yeah, maybe we could get you back on once we've got some reaction to the film as well, and see how you feel about how it's gone down in the farming community.
When you're celebrities.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll not hold our breath until that comes along.
Well, I don't know about you, Han, but I found that conversation with the Dereks and James really fascinating, and I am definitely going to go out of my way to go and watch that film.
And I love the fact that they were both in the same room and they were sharing biscuits and drinking tea. I just love the dynamic they've both got. They're quite chalk and cheese in a lot of respects. And I think probably a lot of farmers can resonate with that, maybe with some of their neighbours. But yeah, I think this film will be a really, really good watch.
We shall wait and see what the reaction to the film is like from the farming community. As we said, maybe we might get them back on at some point.
I'll leave you to your conference and your socks, Phil.
I'm going to go and find you some socks. If I find any paper hats, I've got a funny feeling they probably stopped doing that in about 2005. But if I find any, I will get you one, Han.
Thank you so much. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.